So, well, welcome to our little dive into the Upanishads with a tiny, tiny bit of Vedas. And it's nice to see so many faces that I haven't seen in quite a while. It's a great pleasure to be here. The idea of this talk is that we'll look at the Upanishads in a slightly different light than what you've just done with Jessica. Jessica sort of focused on the ideas of the Upanishads, and in a way what I want to do in this session is look at the stories of the Upanishads. And that in itself is something that often surprises people. People generally think of the Upanishad as just these texts of very high, lofty ideas. But the Upanishads actually have quite a number of stories in them. And a lot of the teachings of the Upanishads are framed in a narrative. There's a sort of a context in which these teachings are given. And so what I want to do in a way is sort of take a step back from the teachings and look at those stories and see what they tell us about the way the teachings are supposed to be transmitted, the way the Upanishads see themselves as providing these teachings in a context of a guru and a student, and what that actually tells us about the Upanishads as a whole and about sort of education in the Upanishadic context. Now, a lot of what we'll be doing is, the reason you have this handout is because there's excerpts from the Upanishads on there, and we'll be reading them together. I sort of invite you to participate in that. The idea is that we read the text together and try and figure out together what the text is saying about these relationships that are in there. Now, just to sort of contextualize this, generally if you pick up any book on the Upanishads, you'll find somewhere in the beginning, in the introduction, said that, well, the word Upanishad means what you have there, sitting down, sat, the root sat being to sit, ni, down, and upa, sort of in the proximity of, so that the word itself refers to the idea that you have to, the teaching is given to one who sits down close to the guru. And so that the term itself for these texts implies already that guru-disciple relationship. Now, interestingly enough, that interpretation of that term is relatively recent, actually. And I've spent some time trying to figure out what's the earliest occurrence of that etymology given of the word Upanishad. And the earliest I got was the beginning of the 19th century. The traditional etymology that's given before that is what you have here, where can mean to sit, but also to sort of lie down or to rest. And so the Upanishads are considered to be those texts that lay to rest completely ignorance or destroy ignorance completely. And that's the interpretation of Upanishad that is generally given by someone like Shankara and the traditional commentators on the Upanishads. Now, this is not to say, as we'll see, the sort of the 19th century reading of the word Upanishad, that's now the dominant way in which the term is understood, does capture something about the nature of these texts and do highlight the importance of the guru in these texts that are given. Because what you have is, what we'll be looking at is the 12 principal Upanishads that are important for Vedanta, for the development of sort of the Vedanta schools. And you have them listed there. And in those 12 Upanishads, which are not all that long, it's sort of in translation, it's a paperback book about this big, you know, so it's not a very lengthy text to altogether. But in those 12 Upanishads, you get 22 main guru narratives or stories about gurus and their disciples. And you know the names are there, and we'll see a couple of those in a moment. And of those 22, what is not included is a number of Upanishads that are clearly some of the shorter Upanishads are clearly sort of intended to be teachings of a guru to a disciple. In some cases, there's even a conversation, the disciple asks questions, but there's no names mentioned. The Isha Upanishad, for example, the first one that you have there, the Isha Vasya, is one of the shortest Upanishads, it's 18 verses, but it's traditionally seen to be a guru teaching a disciple because there's a use of a second person, you, and there's a constant sort of addressing of somebody. And so traditionally they're seen as being teachings of a guru to a disciple. So that's not included in this. So 12 Upanishads, 22 teachings of gurus. Now if you're a quick counter, you'll notice that there's not 22 names down there. That's because some of these teachers that are listed there give more than, sort of teach more than one person in some of the Upanishads, particularly Yajnavalkya. Yajnavalkya and Udalak Aruni. Yajnavalkya is the teacher of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and he teaches several people, and Udalak Aruni, we'll see him at the end of today's session. He's one of the principal teachers of the Chandogya Upanishad. So that's sort of to give you a background for this, the importance of these gurus in the texts. And so the question is, so why do the Upanishads put it in that sort of framework? Why do they not just say, here's a teaching and, you know, this is it? Why do they give such importance to the stories that sort of form the context for the teachings? And there's various opinions on that. But generally, there's sort of two main views that are given by commentators. One is that the stories are important because they associate the teachings with great sages. And so if you, Yajnavalkya is a person that's praised in a lot of texts, and so if you hear that this particular teaching was taught by Yajnavalkya, then you go, oh, this must be important because Yajnavalkya is an important man. And so that it raises your respect for the teachings and your desire to hear the teachings. But the other reason why the stories are said to be important is because they give you the context in which you yourself should receive the teachings as well. And we'll see this is a point that comes up in a number of those stories very explicitly, that this is how you receive those teachings. We'll come to that. Now, this is the first passage you have on the handout there. This is just on the underscoring the importance of the guru in the Upanishads. This is a very famous section from the Chandogya Upanishad, and we'll be looking primarily at the Chandogya because I think it illustrates quite nicely the different roles of the guru in these texts. And this is from the famous sixth chapter, which has the teaching of Tattvamasi, of you are that. You're familiar with, and you'll see at the very end of the passage in the handout, you get that there. That is the truth, that is the self, and that's what you are, Shvetaketu. That's the famous Tattvamasi teaching. But the teaching is given by Udalaka Aruni to his son Shvetaketu, and we'll return to them at the end of the talk. He gives that teaching and illustrates it each time with a different analogy. And this is towards the very end of the chapter, where he says, take for example, son, a man who is brought here blindfolded from the land of Gandhara, which is roughly, sort of, it's part of Afghanistan and a little bit of Pakistan today. So he comes from there, he's taken from there blindfolded, and he's left in a deserted region. As he was brought blindfolded and left there blindfolded in that deserted region, he would drift about there towards the east or the north or the south. Now, if someone were to free him from his blindfold and tell him, go that way, go to the east, the land of Gandhara is in that direction. Being a learned and wise man, he would go from village to village, asking for directions, and finally arrive in the land of Gandhara. In exactly the same way in this world, when a man has a teacher, he knows. There's delay here for me only until I'm freed, but then I will arrive. the man who's brought from Gandhara, he's blindfolded. He doesn't know where he comes from, which direction he has to go. And he also doesn't know the land he's in currently. He's just sort of wandering around aimlessly, hoping to get back home to his family or whatever awaits him back in Gandhara. And he's stumbling around, And so this is Dalekharuni is saying, this is our situation. We're just sort of groping in the dark, trying to find our way home, but we're not quite sure where we are and which way we have to go. And so the guru comes and says, takes off the blindfold and says, go that direction, go over there, go to the east, and you will get there. But then there's two sort of nice touches I find in the passage. One is that the Upanishad says that the guru kind of directs him to that direction. He starts walking in that direction. But then it says that he continues to walk towards the east, toward Gandhara, but he continues to stop from in village and kind of say, is still that way? Or did I sort of lose the way? Did I get lost? They'll say, oh no, yeah, it's over there, just keep going. Or they'll say, no, actually, you missed the last turn and you have to get back, you know, if you just go back a little bit and then turn left there, you'll get there eventually. And so this is something that we'll see is quite typical of the Upanishads, that and which is quite different from the Vedas, in the role of the guru in the Vedas themselves, where there is a continual sort of teaching that can happen even after the initial teaching is given. And so it's not that you've received sort of everything at once, but there's a continual teaching that is can be given that's not necessarily done by the same person that gave you the initial teaching. So keep that in mind as we go through this. But at the same time, what the teacher gives him in the beginning, that forms the basis for all his further understanding and for his further search to get back home, as it says at the very end there. And exactly in exactly the same way in this world, when a man has a teacher, he knows. When a man has received a teacher, or when he's found a teacher, and the teacher directs him to the right sort of points out which way he has to go, then he knows. And what he knows is, there is delay for me here only until I'm freed, but then I will arrive. So he knows, basically, I am home. Even though I'm still far from Gandhara, I'm home because I've received the teachings, the directions how to get home. And so the only thing that sort of prevents me from being home is basically time. So it's just, I will get there, there's just time separating me. So there's delay for me here only until I'm freed. So in the context of Upanishadic teachings, there's a delay here only until I attain liberation. That sort of separates me from attaining God. But then I will arrive. So there's this confidence, this certitude, and this faith in the teachings of the guru that we'll see in some of the narratives as well, is very crucial for the Upanishads. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Now, I'll structure the readings based on an etymology that is given, or three etymologies that are given, of the word Acharya, which is generally the word that is used for teacher in the Upanishads. The word guru is very rarely used in the Upanishads. But the word Acharya is generally the word that's used. It's the word that's used in the passage we just read, and that is translated here as teacher. And anyway, just to give you a little background of where this is coming from, Yaska, he's an author who probably lived around the 6th century BC. He was a person who was interested in etymologies. He wrote a whole book on the etymologies of words. How can we derive the meaning of words from their roots? It's a the text he wrote is immensely influential and very popular. It's a text called the Nirukta, which just means etymologies.
Nirukta,
yeah. But in the work, he gives three different etymologies for the word Acharya. We'll look at sort of all three of them and see how different Upanishadic passages highlight one of those three. The first one he gives is, and I should say that these etymologies are not sort of, in a sense, strict etymologies as you would find it in an etymological dictionary, a modern etymological dictionary. But it's sort of the idea is that the word, you can sort of you can see words, sort of certain verbal roots in the word, and then derive sort of extra meaning from them. And so all these words are understood to have a variety of meaning. So the first he gives is the acharya, the teacher, is he who makes the student understand proper behavior, or achar, the one who teaches the proper way how to act in the world. That is an acharya. And the second one is, he says, he who gathers the objects of knowledge. There, the gathers is the verbal root chi, so achinoti, he who piles up, literally, the objects of knowledge. So he who transmits knowledge to the disciple. And the third one is he who piles up, or sort of who gathers in the disciple, not knowledge, but rather intelligence, buddhi, sort of intellect, the power to discriminate. And so we'll come back to all of those three and see them in greater detail. Now let's start with the first one. The teacher as the person who teaches a student proper behavior, who teaches a student how to act in the world. And this is really the Vedic understanding of the guru. Where in the Vedic understanding, you approach a guru in your childhood, you become a student of the guru. There's an initiation ceremony, the upanayana, literally the leading to the guru, and you express your desire to study the Vedas, and the guru then says, yes, I will accept you as my student. You then live with the guru for the entire duration of your stay, of your studies. And you serve the guru while you're there, and during that period you practice brahmacharya, or you become a brahmachari, meaning you practice celibacy and a life of tapas, or austerity, and so you live a very simple life, you live a very austere life that's fully devoted to the study of the Veda. Now the reason this is so important in the Vedic context is because the Vedas were not sort of books in the sense that we think of books, but were texts that were memorized. And so the way teaching would occur is the guru would recite, say if you're studying the Rig Veda, would start with the beginning of the Rig Veda, and would recite the text. So it's Agni Mide Purohitam Yagyasya Devam Ritvijam Otaram Ratnadatamam, and then the disciple had to repeat that, and then again, and so on, until the student has memorized it. And so it's purely oral that this is done. And so they're taught to live a life of simplicity and austerity in order to help them retain the text in their memory. And traditionally it's said that to memorize one of the Vedas, one of the four Vedas, would take about 12 years. 12 years is just constant drilling the text into your memory
without
having a copy that you can sort of follow along. It's just purely orally, it's a very intense program, it's a program that starts when you're very young, and there's in Dharmashastras there are different ages given for when you should start depending on what your varna is. But it's generally sort of about the age of 7 or 8 you start, and so 12 years later you're basically a young adult and you're ready to start your sort of responsible life in the world, because then the idea is then once you've memorized the Veda, you're supposed to get married, and you start a family, and you perform Vedic rituals with them, in which you use the texts that you've been memorizing your entire childhood.
Is there any institution in the world, including in India, which is teaching this as it was taught?
There are still, there's been a bit of a Vedic revival in the last sort of 50 years or so, or 60 years. Generally, they do make use of printed text nowadays. They sort of use it as sort of an aid in memorization. But there are still some unbroken lineages that go back, centuries of Brahmin families who do this.
Really gentle.
Yeah, and who it's kind of the difficulty they have in sort of the modern world There's actually sort of a strong community in Bangalore, sort of the region there. And one of the things they say is, well, all our sons want to become IT people, and don't want to sort of spend 12 years memorizing these texts. So it's very difficult to do this today. But you still, one of my own teachers, Professor Narasinghacharya, who taught me Sanskrit, he was a Sri Vaishnava from Chennai, one of the world's greatest Sanskritists without a doubt. But he had a friend, he told me once, he said he had one of his close childhood friends who was trained in a Yajurvedic school. And he said the manner in which they memorize these texts is so precise that I say I can go to him carrying a printed edition of the Yajurveda and say, what's the 1,526th word of the Yajurveda? And he says it'll take him a little while to just sort of think of it, but he says, and then he'll say, this is the word, and he says, and I can check and it'll be correct. So that's the precision with which they memorize these texts. So now the reason I mentioned this and the reason how this relates to the idea of achara, of proper behavior, is that this is what you're meant to do. You're meant to memorize the Vedas so that then you can get married and then continue and then perform Vedic rituals yourself, perform yagyas. When you're a brahmachari, when you live with the guru, who often actually is your own father. In some cases, you would go to another family, you'd live with that family, your childhood, you'd be trained there. But often it would be your own father who teaches you. While you're doing that, you're serving your guru, you're assisting him in the performance of Vedic rituals. You can't perform Vedic rituals himself, but you can get firewood and you can sort of prepare everything and so on. We'll see that there's two things that are generally the disciple is generally involved in. One is taking care of the sacred fires, which are supposed to be kept burning for the entire duration of your life. And whenever you perform a yagya, you take fire from your household fire and perform the yagya with that fire that is kept burning. Not that you kind of have sort of a big bonfire in the backyard constantly burning. They're kept in clay pots as sort of just sort of embers of charcoal that's sort of kept burning. So that's taking care of the fires and taking care of the cows of the guru. Those are the two things that are in the Upanishads. The disciples always end up doing. But then you finish your studies, and when you finish your studies, you get this little passage that you have next on the handout. This is from the Taittiriya Upanishad, from the end of the first chapter. Where a guru addresses his disciple after he's finished his studies. He's memorized whatever Veda he's been studying. He's completed his education. Now he's ready to return to his family.
Is it just one Veda at a time?
Sorry?
Is it just one Veda for one person?
Generally, that's the way it was done. We'll see that in some cases there would be people who do more than one Veda, but that's exceptional. But we'll see at the end. There's one of the characters who does more than one Veda.
Yeah, so it's from that emerges the Vedic surname,
Trivedi.
Yeah.
So a Trivedi is somebody that
three.
That would
two.
Have known
two.
A Trivedi is three,
three.
And Chaturvedi is four.
If you only did one, you didn't have a surname.
Yeah, actually, you don't have. Yeah, I suppose it's not something to brag about.
No, exactly.
I know one.
What's the point?
Well, everyone does. generally they would specialize in one, because the Vedas are not short texts. The Rig Veda sort of in print is sort of about this thick, quite a sort of a sizable volume, 1,028 hymns. That range in length from 4 verses to 60 verses each, so it's a massive text. But at the end of the education, this is what the guru teaches, the final instructions he gives. He says you should only perform those rites that are irreproachable, those yagyas, those practices that are beyond reproach, there are proper and never any other types of rites. You should hold in high esteem only those good practices you've observed in me and never other types of practices. So if you see me doing something that wasn't appropriate, don't do that. Just look for the good example that I've set you. You should greet with honor any Brahmin who's superior to us by offering him a seat. You should give with faith and never without faith. You should give with dignity. You should give with modesty. You should give with trepidation. You should give with comprehension. Now, if you ever have a doubt regarding a rite or a practice, should there be experienced, qualified, and gentle Brahmins devoted to Dharma who are able to make a judgment in that matter, you should observe how they act how they act in that regard and behave likewise. And the same with things that are subject to criticism. You should look at the Brahmins and that know Dharma and do likewise. This is the injunction, this is the teaching, this is the hidden teaching, the Upanishad of the Veda. This is the admonition. You should worship in this way. You should indeed worship in this way. And so here, this is the Vedic understanding of the Guru, which you find sort of surfacing in some passages of the Upanishad, where it's the idea is the Guru prepares you for the world, prepares you for acting properly in the world. But at the same time, as you can see here too, there's still sort of further guidance there that later on, if you sort of go, what was that again? What am I supposed to do in this situation? And he says, just go to other Brahmins and ask them. Because often particularly if you live if you go to study with a guru and live with their family, you might not see that guru again for the rest of your life, because you know the guru might actually often would live quite far, and that's why you sort of they're very respected people, and that's why you go and study there, and so you go back to your own community. This is before Facebook and so on, so it's harder to keep in touch over long distances. And so ask the local community what you should do. Now the Upanishads kind of take this one step further and say, yeah, this is nice, you know, it prepares you for a responsible life in the world, a life of yajna and so on, but really there's something more that the guru can do to you for you. There's something there's other things that you can that the guru is important for, and this is the second etymology that is given of the guru is the acharya, is one who gathers the objects of knowledge, one who sort of brings to you the objects of knowledge and gathers them in you, and in a sense that's kind of the dominant way in which the gurus appear in the Upanishads. Where they're just teaching things, there's two stories in particular that highlight this very well, and the importance of the guru in doing that. And it's the story of the first is the story of Satyakama. Now, do you know Satyakama? What do you know of Satyakama?
The one who's being dispatched and then is brought back.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Do you know the details?
The death.
Sorry?
No,
that's Nachiketas. You're the one who is given to death, and then is that the one you're thinking
of? Yeah.
That's Nachiketas. Nachiketas is he saw his father perform a yajna, and his father had to give away sort of in charity at the end of the yajna. But his father didn't have much, and so he had these cows, and he gives away these cows, and Nachiketas sees them and says, well, these cows are old, man. You know, the Brahmins are going to receive these cows, they're not going to be happy.
Steak.
And so he says, you know, I should make up for this, and so what else can my father give? And he says, well, my father can give me, because I'm a good boy, so my father can give me. And so he sort of pestering his father says, will you give me away, will you give me away? And then his father basically says, go to hell or go to death. And then he's given to death. But that's a different story.
Okay.
But do you know the story of Satyakama? I think when I'll tell the story, you'll go, oh.
Yeah.
But the story of Satyakama is, the famous part of the story is that he was a little boy, and he approaches his guru, Haridrumata, he says, you know, please teach me. And his guru says, well, I only teach Brahmins. You know, what's your varna? What's your family background? And he says, well, I don't know. And he says, well, go and ask your father. He says, well, I don't have a father. He says, well, go and ask your mother. So he goes to his mother and he says, so, mom, you know, what sort of Varna, you know? And his mom says, well, I don't know, you know, who your father, what his Varna was, so I don't really know. But my name is Jabali, so you can tell him that you're Saptikama Jabala, and sort of the son of Jabali. And so Saptikama goes back to his guru and he says, oh, well, I'm Saptikama Jabala. And he says, so that's kind of a strange name. What's that? What kind of Varna is that? And he tells the story. He says, well, my mother doesn't know. And then his guru says, because you tell the truth, because you're truthful, you must be a Brahmin. Therefore, I'll teach you. And that's sort of the story that's often told. But it's the remainder of the story that's actually the story we're interested in here. And that's the story that's often overlooked. And the story there is that he then, his guru Haridrumata says, okay, I'll teach you. And he says, but, you know, in the meantime, take care of my cows. And so Satyakama, he's a little boy, he sort of starts herding the cows, and he's, you know, sort of the cows need new pasturing ground, so he's sort of wandering around with the cows in the area, and he makes this vow. He says, I will not go back to the house of my guru until I have 1,000 cows, until the cows have multiplied to 1,000, and that will please my guru. And so he's there, he's sort of, you know, living with those cows for quite a while, and then the moment, the day that the 1,000th calf is born, he says, okay, now I can go back. And so he undertakes the long journey back home to his guru's house. And the first night when he sets up camp, there's a bull from the herd that comes to him and starts teaching him one quarter of Brahman. And he's like, oh, the bull teaching me one quarter of Brahman. And then the bull sort of teaches him a quarter and then says, tomorrow you'll hear the second quarter from the fire. And so the next night, again, he sets up camp, lights a fire. The fire speaks to him and teaches him the second quarter. At the end of that, the fire says, tomorrow night you will be taught by a swan or a goose. And so the next night, same thing. A goose comes, teaches him the third quarter of Brahma. And then here, this is the final one, it's the final teaching comes, the goose then says, and the tomorrow night, the final night before you reach your guru's home, you'll be taught by a bird, who will teach you the fourth quarter of Brahman. And so then he comes home having been taught four quarters of Brahman, so the totality of knowledge of Brahman, and this is what you have in the handout then. What happens next is what you get there. Where he says, the Chandogya says, finally he reached his teacher's house. So he's been traveling for 4 days, so he was presumably quite far away. And so finally he reaches his teacher's house. The teacher called out to him, he says, Satyakama. And Satyakama says, yes, sir. Says, son, you have the glow of a man who knows Brahman. Tell me, who taught you? And so he sees Satyakama there, glowing with knowledge, and but he said, I haven't taught you, I haven't seen you in years, you know, you've been herding those cows the whole time, so who is it that taught you? And Satyakama says, other than human beings, he acknowledged, and this is generally interpreted as, so the other than human being is, you know, the bull, the fire, the goose and the bird. And it's kind of the question that he asks here, that his guru asks him, is quite weighted, because it's basically, you know, for someone to teach another's disciple would be a really great offense to that teacher, because it would basically imply that, you know, if I were to teach somebody else's disciple, it would mean that I don't think this guru is capable of teaching this disciple properly, so I should teach him instead. So it's a great offense to the guru. And so he sees his disciple coming back, glowing with knowledge, sort of peaceful, happy, content, self-controlled, and so on. And so he says, who did this? You know, what happened? And so Satyakama immediately assures him and says, well, this wasn't human beings, because no human being you know, who actually knows Brahman would do something outrageous like that. A lot of the commentators say that the bull, the fire, the goose, and the bird were actually gods who sort of took on those forms and taught him. And the gods can do pretty much whatever they want, so you know, no offense there. But then the interesting part comes. So Satyakama basically knows everything there is to know about Brahman. He's been taught four quarters, so that the totality of Brahman, by these different beings. But then he says, "But I desire, sir, that you teach it to me yourself. For I've heard from people of your eminence that knowledge leads one most securely to the goal only when it is learned from a teacher." So he's basically saying, I know Brahman now. I've learned it all, but please teach me again. Because only when you will teach it to me will that knowledge be really manifest in me. Will I get the benefit of that knowledge? And so his guru, the text continues, So he explained it to him, and indeed he did so without leaving anything out. So nothing that was sort of, he basically teaches him everything over again, and then his knowledge is secure. The story doesn't end there though, because then basically, and we'll come back to it in a moment, but then what happens then is, you know, so Satyakama, he grows up, he himself becomes a guru when he's an adult. And he gets a disciple called Upakosala. Upakosala is a very sort of very determined student, very bright student, very humble student, who lives with Satyakama for 12 years. This is the period you're supposed to study the Vedas. But in those 12 years, Satyakama doesn't teach him anything. There's not a single time when he sits down and says, "Upakosala, come on, I'll teach you something." But Upakosala just keeps serving his guru. He's tending the fires. So Satyakama was taking care of the cows here. He's taking care of the sacred fires that he's doing. And at some point, the Chandogya says, Satyakama's wife kind of gets on his case and says, just teach this boy something. You know, he's been here for 12 years and he's such a good student, and you're just not, you know, you're just ignoring him. You know, just teach him something. And Satyakama was like, oh yeah, fine. But then that night Satyakama goes on a business trip, or he travels, you know, he goes away without teaching Upakosala. And so Upakosala is still there, he's still faithful, he's still sort of sincere, and he continues his service of tending the fires. And while Satyakama is away, the different fires, there's three main fires that are used in Vedic Yajnas that he's supposed to sort of take care of. And then there's a fourth fire, sort of, well, that actually says all the fires together. They start teaching him. And again, the commentators say it's the gods who sort of manifest the sort of themselves in the fires who start teaching him. Perhaps thinking that, well, you know, his guru's not teaching him anything, we might as well do it. And so they start teaching him every night. One of the fires teaches him, and then what you have there in the handout is the final night, at the end of the final teachings of the last of the collective fires who teach him. It then says, "Then the fires told him, 'Upakosala son, now you have this knowledge both of ourselves, the knowledge of Vedic Yajnas, which they've been teaching him, as well as the knowledge of the self, of the Atman. Your teacher, however, will point out the path to you.'" And the next day, his teacher finally returned. The teacher called out to him, "Upakosala." And Upakosala says, "Sir, how can I serve you?" He says, "Son, your face glows like that of a man who knows Brahman. Tell me, who taught you?" Same scenario as we had, as he had in his own childhood. Upakosala says, "Well, who could possibly have taught me, sir? There's no one around here." And in so saying, he denies it in a way. Some commentators say he sort of first kind of says, "Well, nobody taught me." And then, as we'll see, he admits it. Some commentators say that nobody really taught him because there's no person that taught him. It's the fires that taught him. So he's not being sort of deceitful in any way. So who could possibly have taught me, sir? And in so saying, he denies it in a way, sort of, he's as if denying it. And alluding to the fires, he continues, these look like this now, they look like fire now, but they were different before. They appeared as persons and taught me before. And then Satyakama says, what did they tell you, son? And this he acknowledged. So he basically tells them everything they taught him. And then Satyakama responds, he says, they did indeed tell you about the world, my son, but I will tell you that about which it is said, when someone knows it, bad actions do not stick to him, just as water does not stick to a lotus leaf. Sir, please teach me that. And this is what he told him. And then you get a long section on the teachings that Satyakama gives to his disciple Upakosala, which is not all that different from what the fires have taught him. Now, what is the passage saying? Why is Satyakama has to be retaught by his guru, and why does Upakosala, his education, also not complete until his guru actually teaches him again? And this is where I'd like to hear your views. How do you make sense of that? Why are, you know, they have the knowledge, they've received the knowledge. What's the point of, you know, just doing it all over again?
Is it validating in a tradition?
Mm-hmm. And
that there is a guru?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was mentioned before, it is the guru which actually shows you the path. So is it almost like a process which you have to go through, and then and that is when you can go and move ahead in your life through the guru.
But,
you have this blessing.
But why is that important, since he seems to know it already?
I suppose just having knowledge is different to living it and to applying it. I suppose linking sort of knowledge and this of self or taking moksha or something. So then the instruction is the link between something and the two.
Mm.
Or is it necessary from one human being to the other? To how to apply it, because it was not taught by another human being, it's taught by other beings, so to speak.
The University of Fire didn't have any accreditations.
Well, the diploma got burnt.
Yeah.
Is the knowledge different to this one? So the really good to this one.
It doesn't become knowledge till the guru has given.
Yeah, that's kind of what's implied here. Even though the interesting thing is that Satyakama and Upakosala, they both come back and their gurus respond and say, wow, you glow with, you know, you have the glow of somebody who knows Brahman. So clearly the knowledge is there in a sense, and they're, you know, it means they're self-controlled, they're peaceful, they're content, they're happy, and so the effect of the knowledge in a way is there. So it's not that they're not taught real knowledge first, and that is just sort of there, and they just haven't understood it. It's sort of changed and their being, and this is what their gurus realize. This is what prompts their guru to ask that question. But then, why does the guru have to do it again? The Upanishads don't directly address it, don't directly say, here's why they need to do it. The commentators all have sort of various ideas on why this is important, why the guru has to do it himself personally.
Might lose his job, maybe. Also, I think it's another thing if you have knowledge, but how do you do with it?
Mm.
How you apply it? Mm. It's not the guru will probably
have
questions and
Yeah. And I think, if you look at the second passage of Upakosala, the fires, the final teaching they give him at the end of that, they say, so now you have this knowledge both of yogya, of ourselves, of the fires, and of the self. Your teacher, however, will point out the path to you. Several commentators sort of highlight this as being the important part, as saying that you have received the knowledge. Now it's about, as a number of you mentioned, it's about application. It's about knowing how to apply this teaching in your life. You need that guidance of the guru who can correct you when you get it wrong, rather than just the bull who kind of comes, gives us, you know, moves his teachings and then sort of walks off again, or the bird who sort of, you know, flies by and sort of teaches him something and then is gone again. You need the person who's there, who can train you, who can guide you in knowing how to apply it, knowing not just what the knowledge is, but also what the knowledge means to you as an individual, and how you should practice that knowledge. Some commentators go a different direction, a slightly different direction, and say actually one of the important things of the need for a guru is, and I think you have to keep in mind, taking a step back, I think it's important to keep in mind the oral nature of the Vedas, because for us to if you want to know the Vedas, you go to the library or you go to your bookshelf, you pick up the Rig Veda from the shelf, you open the book and you read it and there it is. If the text is an oral text, if there are no printed books or no manuscripts of the text, the only way I can study the text is if I go to somebody who's memorized the text and say, you know, please teach me what the text is saying. And so that's one of the reasons why the guru is particularly important in such a context. But a number of the commentators say, well, it's more than that. It's more than just and these are particularly the theistic commentators who say that what you're taught is not an abstract concept, but what you're taught is about you, the Atman, your real self, and its relationship with Brahman. And for particularly in some of the other Upanishads, and we'll look at one in just a moment, there's a very clear sort of theistic understanding of Brahman. And some of the Upanishads lean more to sort of a Nirguna sort of understanding of Brahman. Some lean more to a theistic understanding of Brahman. So some of the commentators that lean sort of more to the theistic one say, the knowledge of Brahman that you receive is basically a knowledge of a relationship between you and God. And that knowledge of that relationship can only come through a relationship. You only learn how to sort of reciprocate behave in that relationship through the guru, who's the representative, who's sort of the embodiment of God. And so you learn it through that, and therefore that relationship is essential. Therefore, just reading about it in a book or just being taught by a bull or by a fire is not enough. You need to sort of then act upon that in that relationship, and it's only then that it really comes out. And you get this verse you get there at the bottom of the page from the Shvetashvatara. This is the final verse of the entire Shvetashvatara Upanishad, and the Shvetashvatara is very clearly theistic. It's the only Upanishad that uses the word bhakti in this verse actually, and it says at the end there. So having taught everything in the Upanishad. Its final teaching is, it says, only in a man who has the deepest love, the deepest bhakti for God, and who shows the same bhakti towards his teacher as towards God, do these points declared by the Noble One shine forth. Do all these points that we've just discussed in the entire Upanishad, they will only manifest to someone who has bhakti, not just to God, not just to Brahman, but also in the same way as he has it to Brahman, to the Guru. And then the teaching sort of manifests. So anyway, that's sort of a different way of looking at it as well. That it's the seva that they perform, the service that both Satyakama and Upakoshala perform to their gurus, that's the reason they need to be taught by their guru. They didn't serve the gods who manifest in these things, but they did serve their guru, and therefore it's only by service that the knowledge has to come from the person they serve. Does that make sense?
Would that be because in that time there's no university to say you've got a BSc or piece of paper to say you've got an MD or whatever. Mm. So to the outside world, it would have meant that the guru would have to rubber stamp or authenticate his student. Because then the student could say, yes, I was taught by this guru.
Yeah, there is some consideration of that, and there you do find sort of lineages of gurus, and there's often the importance of who you studied with and so on, that's definitely there. But as we'll see in a moment, that's not always a guarantee that, you know, I have a good guru, but I'm really rubbish, you know. That could be the situation. We'll see some stories, and the Upanishads do make that point, that you might have brilliant teachers, but it's about, you know, you just might be a really bad student and just not have gotten the point of what they're teaching. So there is this kind of, both sides are there in the Upanishad. Some is like, you know, importance is given to the type of person you study with, and whose disciple you are. But then at the same time, there's also an emphasis on, you know, it's up to you and we'll come to that now, actually. We've done that. And this is the third meaning of the word acharya that Yaska gives. Of he who gathers intelligence, he who gathers in his disciple not just knowledge but intellect, buddhi. Then you get again in the Chandogya Upanishad, there's two stories that illustrate this very, very vividly and quite beautifully, I think. And the longest one of that is the story you get in the eighth chapter of the Chandogya, the final chapter of the Chandogya Upanishad, which is a story of Indra and Virochana, and how they're being taught by Prajapati, by their father. Now, Indra, he's the king of the gods, of the devas. He's the leader of the devas. Virochana is the leader of the asuras. And they're siblings. They're both children of Prajapati, who in sort of Puranic texts is generally identified with Brahma. And so he, Indra and Virochana, the background to this is they're fighting with each other. They're enemies. The devas and the asuras are always fighting with each other. But one day they hear that if you know the Atman, if you know the Self, then you can become free from disease, free from weakness, free from death, and so on. And you get a long list of all the things that you become free from. And both are kings, both are warriors, and they hear this and think, oh, this would be really good for our fight. You know, if we know the Atman, we'll be invincible in our battle with the other side, with the devas or the asuras. And so they go to Prajapati, to their father, and they say, they come to Prajapati, and then you get the passage you get on the handout on page 3. They, Indra and Virochana, lived the life of celibate students for 32 years. And so they go to Prajapati, they live the life of Brahmacharya, spent there 32 years. And after 32 years, Prajapati says to them, why have you lived here? What do you want? It's like, what have you been doing here for 32 years? And they replied, they said, sir, people report these words of yours. We've heard that you've said this. The self that is free from evils, free from old age and death, free from sorrow, free from hunger and thirst, the self whose desire and intentions are real, that is the self that you should try to discover. That is the self that you should seek to perceive. When someone discovers that self and perceives it, he obtains all the worlds and all his desires are fulfilled. So that's what they heard, and that's what they said. This is what we want. We want to obtain all the worlds and all our desires are fulfilled. And so temporarily they're enemies, but temporarily they've kind of said, okay, we'll just, you know, forget our enmity and, you know, try and get that teaching so we can then, you know, go back to defeating each other. So they say, this is why we've lived with you for 32 years. And so you get a similar scenario with Upakosala. They've lived there for a long time. Prajapati just didn't teach them. So it's kind of, you know, testing the patient. I think there's very few people who would spend 32 years living with a teacher in the hope that one day he might sort of kind of go like, oh, who are you? What are you doing here? he says, Prajapati says, so you've lived here seeking that self, so this is why you're here. And so he says, he then starts teaching them. And he says, Prajapati then told him, this person that one sees here in the eye, that is the self. That is the immortal, that is the one free from fear, that is Brahman. It doesn't say who, Indra or Virochana, presumably both, they say then, but then, sir, who's the one that's seen here in the water and here in a mirror? And when we look in the mirror, we see our reflection. Who's that, what we see? Prajapati says, well, it's the same one who's seen in all these surfaces. He teaches them, he says, look at yourself in a pan of water and let me know if there's anything you do not perceive about yourself. And so they looked into a pan of water and Prajapati asked them, what do you see? And they replied, sir, we see here our entire body, a perfect likeness down to the very hairs of the body, down to the very nails. And so they say, we see ourselves reflected there. And Prajapati says, well, that's the self. And he then tells them, he says, you know, put jewelry on you, you know, makeup and jewelry and so on, and look again into the water, and what do you see? And they say, oh, we see, you know, it's like the jewelry is covering up our body, and we see it, we see everything as we decorated ourselves, we see it there in the pan of water. And again he says, well, what you see there is that. And then it says, and the two of them left with contented hearts. And the two of them go, like, ah, we got it. 32 years, but it was worth it. We finally got the knowledge of Atman. And so they both go home. and Prajapati sort of, you know, he's given that teaching, and they immediately they go, okay, time to go home now. 32 years is long enough. Let's get back to business. So they leave, and as they leave, Prajapati says, there they go, without learning about the self. Without discovering the self, the side that will hold to this teaching, whether it's the gods or the demons, is bound to be vanquished. the text continues. Now Virochana, he was totally content. He goes back to the demons and he announced to them this teaching. And he says, what I've learned from Prajapati is this. This is the most important thing we should do. So it's the body that one should extol in this world. It is the body that we should care for. When someone extols the body alone in this world, when he cares only for the body, he wins both this world and the next. So this is, you know, great teaching. We'll be invincible. We will win every world. And the Upanishad comments, he says, therefore even today people here say of a man who gives no gifts, who has no faith and offers no sacrifices, what a demonic fellow. This is indeed the teaching that demons hold to. They perform the funerary rites for the body of a dead person with offerings of food, garments and ornaments, for they believe that in this way they will win the next world. And so this is Virochana. He's received the teaching, he's happy. He goes home and says, you know, we'll take care of our bodies, we'll become invincible. Indra, on the other hand, he goes home, and as he's traveling home, he kind of goes like, what Prajapati taught doesn't make any sense. You know, it's just, it's because we're asking for the self that is free from disease and free from death and free from hunger and thirst. And he tells us, look in the mirror and you see what you see there, that's the self. But the self in the mirror, that's basically my body. My body gets sick and my body gets old and my body gets hunger and thirst. And so he says, this doesn't make any sense. So he goes back to Prajapati. You get then, if you turn the page, it says there, so he returned again carrying firewood in his hands. So he goes as a student carrying firewood for the guru's fires, for his yajnas. And Prajapati said to him, says, Maghavan, Indra, didn't you leave together with Virochana with contented hearts? So why have you come back? What do you want? And basically Indra says, well, what you taught me doesn't make any sense. You know, I see no value in that teaching. And then Prajapati tells him at the very end of the paragraph or the section there, Prajapati told him, it's exactly as you say, Maghavan, but I will explain it to you further. Stay here for another 32 years. And he stays for another 32 years. Prajapati gives him another teaching, which says, well, the self is that which you see in dreams. And then Indra again goes, oh, great, go home. Before he gets home, he goes, this doesn't make any sense. Goes back to Prajapati, and Prajapati says, another 32 years. He lives there another 32 years. Then Prajapati says, well, the self is that which you see in deep sleep when there's no dreams. Again, Indra says, oh great, thanks a lot, goes away. As he goes away, he says, this doesn't make any sense, goes back to Prajapati, she says, well, live for another 5 years. It's a little shorter. He lives there for another 5 years, and then finally he gives him the highest teaching about the nature of the self, and Indra learns it, and everything is good. Now, why is Prajapati doing this? What's Prajapati doing to Indra and Virochana? Why does he make them wait? Why does he make them? Why does he? Is he teaching them ignorance? Is he? What's he doing?
Self-realization, so making them learn for themselves.
Well, they're gods, you know, they live very long lives.
He must be really fond of them.
He must be fond of them?
Yeah, didn't want them to go.
That's
the reason. He liked having someone to bring him firewood.
Yeah. After the cows.
On their cheeks.
Someone in the back?
It's not easily acquired, the knowledge. It has to come from the being as well. But just to be taught to miss some meetings, live life, go through that contemplation, maybe.
Yeah. But then the question, of course, comes up. Is Prajapati misleading them?
Well, not really, because he's showing them what the self isn't, which is this.
But he seems to be saying this is the self.
Yes, but he's not really misleading, because he's, I suppose he's saying that self, it is that part of you is the self, but it's not everything. And that's what he's trying to get them to understand.
It's not what you see. The self is there, but it's not.
So, in a way, he's teaching them parts of what the nature of the self is, but by doing that, he's sort of helping Indra get to the realization that it's not just one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you can't be a baby solid food.
And is this a way of contrasting with
Virochana?
Because both go off in with the same knowledge, go off in completely opposite directions.
Mm. Yeah.
It is that questioning, doesn't it? Keeps coming back, because he thinks that's true and thinks that can't be right.
Mm.
And also, could it be relative to those times?
Mm.
Because obviously it was Indra and Virochana. They were the gods, these demons. And Pakosala and Satyakama were just mere mortals, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to ensure that he did a proper job, kind of thing, is one practical.
Yeah, we'll see that. It applies also to humans in a moment.
I guess also, kind of like, cause when Indra came back, he asked like a better question.
Mm.
And he, like, I don't know, maybe it's he's actually trying to sort out his thinking processes, so he actually asks the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just give someone an answer, I guess it's the Oxford system, like, if you just give someone an answer, they probably forget it, or they won't really understand the way to get to it. Whereas, we try to teach from, like, which I hate, we try to teach from, like, first principles, and so therefore, like, the idea is that even if you don't know the answer, you can work it out again.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we learned, like, throwing the wall, which seems completely useless. But here, like, he kind of, like, he came back and said, well, hold on, it doesn't work because of this and this and this. So instead of just knowing the answer, he actually learned a lot more. He learned how to think for himself.
Yeah. I suppose there's less pressure on Indra and Virochana because there's no final exam that they have to prepare for. There's some debates amongst the commentators whether what Prajapati first teaches them, whether that's actually, is he teaching them something that's true or something that's partially true or something that's actually wrong and he's testing them. And
but I mean, in the beginning, doesn't he not? He doesn't really say anything. He shows them themselves in a reflection, and they reach the conclusion.
And so you get the initial teaching. If you look back at that, he says this person that one sees here in the eye, that is the self, that is the immortal, that is the one free from fear. That is Brahman. This is an Upanishadic teaching that comes back in a few places, that the self that is there in the eye, it's not sort of literally that, you know, you sort of
it's
cut open the eye and
it.
You
but
pull out the self. But it's the one that perceives, the one sort of consciousness, basically. That's the nature
of it. From knowledge to intelligence, is that the process that he's trying to get to?
Yeah. So he's kind of giving them, or some commentators would say, he's giving them the full teaching in the beginning. And it's Indra and Virochana kind of just think, oh, this is what it is, and this is what it must be. And before Prajapati can do anything else, they kind of go, oh, thanks a lot, bye, and they're gone. And that's why Prajapati says when they leave, he says, sort of halfway down the page, he says, there they go, without learning about the self. They've not figured it out. Some commentators emphasize that what Prajapati is doing is, first he's teaching them about the nature of the body, and then as sort of the idea of you gradually lead in the sort of, you don't give a baby solid food, you kind of gradually lead them. So it's first the body, then the mind, then consciousness itself, and then ultimately to the real nature of the self and its relationship with Brahman. That sort of gradually you build it up like that, which is the way the Upanishads do it in other passages as well. Where in some sense the body can be considered our self, because it's our social self and so on. Our identities in this world have to do with our body. But then ask a deeper question, don't just go there. This is where the Vedic ritualists sort of end, where they say, well, I'm a Brahmin, I perform yagyas and so on. I'm a married man, and this is all important for me performing a yagya. But then they say, well, think deeper. What are you? Are you just the body? And it's like, no, I have thoughts. Okay, I'm the mind then. Oh, well, but there's more than the mind. Well, what's more than the mind? There's consciousness. I'm aware of my thoughts. And then ultimately you lead it all the way back to Brahman. And so it's a gradual way. But the way he's doing it is by sort of very consciously not giving, sort of spoon-feeding everything, but letting the students figuring it out for themselves, as some of you were mentioning. And this is quite, just to sort of end the final passage, as for very briefly, this is one of the most famous chapters of the Upanishads. This is the Tattvamasi chapter that we started with. This is what you have there, is the very beginning of this. And this is the story of Shvetaketu and his father Udalaka Aruni. Now Shvetaketu is always presented in the Upanishads as a real arrogant young chap. He's a sort of person who's full of himself and, you know, thinks he's the best thing in the world. Sort of a blessing to whoever he meets. And his father, on the other hand, Udalaka Aruni, is always presented as a very humble man, very learned, very wise, one of the wisest people in the Upanishads, but very humble, very well-behaved, very sort of modest about his own learning. And so the chapter starts, this is what leads into the teaching of Tattvamasi, where it says, there was one Shvetaketu, the son of Aruni, the son of Udalaka Aruni, and one day his father told him, Shvetaketu, take up the celibate life of a student, for there's no one in our family, my son, who has not studied and is the kind of Brahmin who's only by birth, who's a Brahmabandhu, who's a relative of a Brahmin, not an actual Brahmin, who, you know, sort of actually knows the Vedas. So he turns to him and says, as we see in the next line, so he went away to become a student at the age of 12. This is late for, as we saw earlier. It's sort of 7-8 years old. That's kind of when you start. And so it's basically Udalaka is kind of telling his son that, you know, get off the couch, you know, go and get an education, you know, just get on with, you know, sort of what are you doing? You're just hanging around here. You're not starting your education, and it's time you do it. It'll take you a long time to memorize the Vedas, so better, you know, do it now. Otherwise, you will never get there. You know, sort of the mind, the memory does kind of become, it's more difficult to memorize things the older you get. And so and And so Shvetaketu, he says, okay, fine, I'll go. And he leaves at the age of 12, and he comes back when he's 24. He spent his 12 years studying there. And he comes back, he's memorized all the Vedas, not just one, but all of them, all four of them. So he's doing pretty well. But he comes back, and as it says, he returned when he was 24, swell-headed, thinking himself to be learned and arrogant. His father then said to him, Shvetaketu, here you are, my son, swell-headed, thinking yourself to be learned and arrogant. So you must have surely asked about that rule of substitution by which one hears what has not been heard of before, thinks of what has not been thought of before, and perceives what has not been perceived before. It's basically the standard Upanishadic question that by knowing which you know everything. So that when you hear it, there's nothing left for you to hear. You've heard everything there is to hear. And so he says, there you are, my son. You've spent 12 years studying all the Vedas. You're so brilliant, so intelligent, so great. So surely, you know, you know this. And Shvetaketu says, well, I don't know, what's that, you know? And Vidalika then teaches his son, you know, through three analogies. He says it's by means of one lump of clay, one would perceive everything made of clay. The transformation is a verbal handle, a name, while the reality is just it's clay. And so he kind of gives these analogies, and then at the end, at the bottom of the page, he says, that son has had this rule of substitution works. And now, the question that Udalaka asks his son is quite significant and is often overlooked. You know, he says, if you go back to sort of the initial thing, he says to his son, he says, so you must, he doesn't say, surely you know this, but he says, surely you must have asked this. And so you must have surely asked about this rule of substitution by which one hears what has not been heard of before, and so on. And this is one of the you know, you see it in the story of Indra and Virochana, but this is one of the recurring themes in the Upanishads, is that the guru is not supposed to teach unless the student asks. And there's a lot of discussion in later literature as well. You memorize the whole Veda, and when you memorize the whole Veda, you're just memorizing the text. You're just making sure the text is there in your head, but you then should go to your guru and say, what does this all mean? You know, what's the point of all this? What have I just been doing for 12 years? What's the point of that? And there's an emphasis that unless the disciple does this, the guru will not actually tell you that. And that seems sort of, to us, perhaps a little sort of unfair or sort of mean. But the idea behind it is, as we've seen in the story of Indra and Virochana, is that by asking the question, you show you're ready for the knowledge. You show your eligibility to actually be able to understand. If that question doesn't arise in you, you're not ready for that knowledge. If you don't go, well, so what's the point of yagyas? You know, so we do these yagyas and then, you know, we go to heaven and blah, blah, blah. And so what's the point of that? If you ask that question, then the guru will say, well, actually, there's moksha, which is higher, which you can reach by knowing Brahman. Forget about the rituals and so on. That's just a means to that. But unless you ask that question, the guru will not teach you because you're not ready for that. And so this is where we see this is applicable also to human beings. And so Shvetaketu, he thinks he's the greatest scholar in the world. And his father kind of puts it in place and says, you're so smart, you're so intelligent. So surely you must have asked this question. And he goes, what's that? And then his response at the very bottom of the page is very telling. And so he says, you know, Udalaka says, well, this is how this works. This is what this teaching is. And then he says, surely those illustrious men, my gurus, who've taught me, did not know this. For had they known, how could they not have told it to me? So why don't you, sir, tell me yourself? And he kind of doesn't get the point. You know, he doesn't get how his father is trying to put him down and say, you're not as smart as you think you are because you don't even know how to ask the right questions. And he goes, my gurus probably weren't that good, you know, because if they were that good, they would have taught. If they knew them themselves, they would have taught me. And it's quite telling. This is the only story in the Upanishad where the guru takes the initiative. In every other, you know, it's basically him sort of trying to put his son in his proper place and saying, you know, here's the teaching. But every other story, it's the disciple comes to the guru and says, please teach me that. And then the guru says, okay, I'll teach you. But it's the student has to make the first move, has to show that he's not just desiring of it, but actually, well, by desiring it, shows that he's ready to receive that knowledge, ready to understand it. And so we see that in Indra and Virochana, gradually Indra keeps on asking the right questions, so he gets the ultimate teaching. Virochana is just goes like, oh great, you know, I got it, easy, that was just 32 years for immortality, great, that was worth it. He doesn't get it because he doesn't show the aptitude for it. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, so the thing is how you learn is as important as what you learn.
Hmm. Hmm. Yeah.
Where does Quran fit in all this?
Well, they're an entirely other sort of corpus of texts.
Yes.
Generally, much
time frame later. Earlier?
Later. Yeah, and they're much sort of more narrative than the Upanishad. I mean, basically, we sort of looked at the narratives, but then there's lots of teaching that come.
Right.
The Puranas are much more narrative. It's basically all the stories of the devas and so on that
simpler.
Some of them, but a lot of them are quite complicated.
I will try.
Ask questions. Are the Upanishads put together from all over India over time? Or are they of a certain time?
Generally, the sort of the consensus is that they're composed somewhere between the 8th century and 5th, 4th century BC, some perhaps even a little later, some weeks. And it's kind of the stories are located in particular places, and all the places are kind of from the Punjab
from, yeah,
to kind of Bihar, basically, that sort of stretch in North India, Ganges and Indus sort of valleys, those places, that's where all the stories are located. Anyway, I think you have lunch now.
Thank you.